This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
It will be important to see conduct of the new transitional government is, in fact, of a nature that is vastly different than what we've seen from the security services under the previous regime.
That's former U.S. diplomat Peyton Knopp of the U.S. Institute of Peace on the U.S. conditions for improvements in Sudan before the country is removed from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Details coming up. Also, we will look into Nigeria generating an estimated 32 million tons of solid waste per year, one of the highest amounts in Africa. And the UN says some 3.7 million refugee children do not go to school and will not gain the skills needed to build a productive future. We have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Several countries on the African continent are undergoing historic political transformations. In places ranging from the Gambia to Zimbabwe, long-entrenched authoritarian leaders have left the stage, opening space for reform and new voices. This week, two countries, Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo, made major announcements unveiling new leadership. VOA's Salem Salamon has been covering the event and is here to break down why this is important. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Salem.
Thanks for having me.
First, Salem, let's talk about Sudan. Sudan has sworn in its sovereign council, and there are some interesting people in this group. What can you tell us about them, and why is it such an important change?
Yes, so the Sovereign Council was part of a negotiated power-sharing agreement between the military and protesters led by the Sudanese Professionals Association, a group of doctors, health workers, and lawyers. It's made up of 11 members, 6 civilians and 5 members of the military. The council will collectively lead the country until elections are held in 2022. What is notable about this is the civilian component includes 2 women, Raja Nikla Isa Abdelmassah, is a judge and a member of the Sudan's Coptic Christian minority, and Aisha Musa Saeed is an educator and longtime women's rights activist. So people are hoping that the fact that these women will have a significant voice in deciding the future of the country will mean that they will speak up not only for women's rights, but the rights of religious and ethnic minorities in the country.
And I'm just curious, Salem, what role have women played historically in protest movements in Sudan?
Well, women have long played a role in Sudanese politics and protest movements. During the country's 1964 revolution, when students stood up to a military regime, women were among those protesting on the front lines. In subsequent years, women joined the judicial system and were given the right to vote. In 1965, Fatma Ahmed Ibrahim became the first woman elected to parliament in Sudan and one of the first on the African continent. But over the decades, Bashir's rule, women's rights eroded in some areas and did not advance in others. Laws restricted women's dress and required them to seek approval from a male relative to marry, although one quarter of the parliament was reserved for female members. They were still often viewed as being token with little power. At the time of the 2018 revolt, women were well represented. In fact, the symbol of the revolution became a woman, Alla Sala, who stood up on top of a vehicle leading chants. So the women of Sudan rightly say this is not about token representation. They've earned a right to have a seat at the table and a voice in deciding the future of Sudan.
Very interesting. So moving on to the DRC, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, President Felix Tshisekedi was elected in January, but is just now announcing his cabinet. I understand not everyone is happy about this. What have you learned about the cabinet and the reaction to it?
That's correct. So the cabinet was announced 7 months after Tshisekedi won the highly contested, and even allegations of rigging has been coming in. And so highly contested election. The 65-member cabinet includes 25 appointees from Tshisekedi's Direction of Change party and 42 from former President Joseph Kabila's Common Front for Congo coalition. But members of the DRC's numerous other political parties are warning that the cabinet gives too much power to allies of the former president and not enough to the opposition voices. So, in fact, Ameri Kalwara, president of the opposition group Congolese Coalition, said that Tshisekedi's predecessor, Kabila, is still the puppet master controlling the government and never truly left office. However, Tshisekedi's allies strongly reject this notion. Abraham Lukabwanga, president of the press to Tshisekedi, told VOA our colleague James Buddy that 76% of the cabinet are new to the government. He also stressed that the cabinet is diverse and includes representatives of all 26 of DRC's provinces, including women and young people who previously did not have a voice in government.
So what does this conflict between the opposition and the newly announced cabinet imply for the future of the country?
Well, the DRC has major problems, including rampant corruption, poverty, poor infrastructure, rebel groups, and an Ebola outbreak. And so this even to even begin to address these problems, they need to a functioning, capable central government, in addition to strong leadership at the provincial level. So observers believe if the divided government can bring multiple voices and powerful interests together for the good of the country, it has a chance to be successful. If it ends up being an extension of the Kabila regime, it will likely fail. So in an interview recently, Tshisekedi's spokesperson seemed to grasp the importance of this moment. He said, "It's time to work. We don't have time to waste."
VOA Salem Salomon, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
A senior U.S. official says the United States will test the commitment of Sudan's new transitional government to human rights, freedom of speech, and humanitarian access before it agrees to remove the country from a state sponsor of terrorism list. New Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok vowed to stabilize the country and solve its economic crisis. He's seeking up to $10 billion in foreign funding to cover Sudan's import bill and help it to rebuild. Washington lifted a 20-year trade embargo against Sudan in 2017 and was in the process of discussions on removing it from the U.S. list when the military stepped in on April 11th to depose President Omar al-Bashir. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Peyton Knopp, advisor to the Africa program at the United States Institute of Peace and a former U.S. diplomat with expertise on Africa and the Middle East, about reasons preventing the U.S. from removing Sudan from that list after the military shared power with the pro-democracy movement.
It's a bit premature for the United States to make a decision about the state sponsor of terrorism designation until we see, first and foremost, that the character of the government really is predominantly civilian in nature, as the Constitutional Declaration implies, and that in particular the Prime Minister and the Cabinet have the preponderance of authority over decision-making, including of the security services. The security services primarily who were responsible for the actions that precipitated the state sponsor of terror designation in the first instance. And so it will be important to see the conduct of the new transitional government is, in fact, of a nature that is vastly different than what we've seen from the security services under the previous regime.
Sudan's new Prime Minister, Abdallah Hamdok, vowed to stabilize the country and solve its economic crisis. He said he was seeking up to $10 billion in foreign funding to cover Sudan's import bill and help rebuild its economy. How could he get such funds while Sudan is still on the terrorism sponsor list, which limits Sudan's access to international financing?
There are certainly a number of limitations that the state sponsor of terrorism designation places on, for example, U.S. voting within international financial institutions such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. It's important to note that the state sponsor of terror designation is not the only mechanism that imposes restrictions. There are also legislative restrictions that the Congress has imposed that govern U.S. assistance to Sudan going back some decades. There are other executive branch imposed restrictions going back really to 1989. So there's a web of restrictions here. And so I think it's important, first and foremost, to recognize that it's not just solely the state sponsor of terrorism designation that provides these limitations. Having said that, it's also important to note that other donors around the world, while they have some similar sanctions and restrictions in place, they don't have all of them. And so I think what really we need to see in the near term is an evidence-based assessment conducted by the international donors, but in close partnership with the new prime minister, with his cabinet, and with the various ministries and institutions of Sudan to really ground truth both the magnitude of the need and the specific requirements that will be necessary to deal with the macroeconomic and fiscal crisis. And then that can underlie a very data-driven conversation about the kinds of international assistance that will be required. I think certainly the Sudanese people are in desperate need of economic relief. There's no question of that, nor is there a question of the magnitude of the funding that will be required. I have some confidence that if there's a partnership between the international community and the transitional government, a way forward can be found, both in the near term and in the long term. But it's going to take a concerted effort on both sides and close cooperation to make that happen.
How should the United States help Sudan's transition to democracy other than lifting sanctions?
The United States can continue to reiterate both in words and in deed the importance of seeing the primacy of civilian authority in the course of the transition and really ensure that civilians are in charge of decision-making during this transitional period leading up to election. The United States' foremost asset remains the ability to convene a wide array of international stakeholders together, both on the donor side in terms of foreign assistance and relief, but also on the political side to make sure that there's a united international consensus on the kind of and the character of a government that can not only achieve the aspirations of the Sudanese people, but also around the character of a government that can maintain stability within the country and make a meaningful contribution to international peace and security. And I think really only the United States has the sort of unique convening of power to build that international consensus and support Prime Minister Hamdok and his colleagues in building that sort of new Sudanese state.
That was former U.S. diplomat Peyton Knopp of the U.S. Institute of Peace speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shinawi. The World Health Organization says the Ebola epidemic in the Democratic Republic of Congo has reached two grim milestones, surpassing 3,000 cases and 2,000 deaths. More than 1 year after the epidemic was declared, it continues to spread, with a young girl dying in Uganda. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
That is the second worst Ebola outbreak after the 2014 West African epidemic, which infected more than 28,000 people and killed more than 11,000. Most Ebola cases in the current epidemic are in the Democratic Republic of Congo's conflict-ridden North Kivu province. The World Health Organization says Ebola transmission has been substantial, but somewhat less intense for the past 10 weeks. On average, it says 80 people a week are being sickened by the virus. One of the latest confirmed cases is that of a 9-year-old Congolese girl who tested positive for Ebola in Uganda on Wednesday. She is the second confirmed case of Ebola in Uganda. WHO spokeswoman Fadela Shaib tells VOA the child had traveled from the DRC with her mother to seek care in Uganda.
When she showed at the border, she was showing all the symptoms of an Ebola case. She was bleeding from the mouth, a rash, very sick, fever, etc. So this girl was taken care of in an Ebola treatment center. And we are now working with the Ugandan and DRC authorities to try to trace all the contact of this family, the mother and the girl.
Unlike previous outbreaks, health workers have new effective tools to help them tackle the deadly disease. The WHO says more than 200,000 people in the DRC and in four neighboring countries have been vaccinated against Ebola. Two therapeutic treatments are saving the lives of people who seek early treatment. The WHO says more than 89 million people have been screened for the disease inside the DRC and at international borders. This, it says, has helped control the spread of the disease by identifying and providing care to anyone with symptoms. However, ongoing insecurity in North Kivu and Ituri provinces, as well as community mistrust, continue to be major impediments to international efforts to bring the epidemic to an end. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz, on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. The United States will test the commitment of Sudan's new transitional government to human rights before it agrees to remove the country from a state sponsor of terrorism list. And the World Health Organization says the Ebola epidemic in the Democratic Republic of Congo has reached two grim milestones. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Nigeria generates an estimated 32 million tons of solid waste per year, one of the highest amounts in Africa. Of that figure, plastic constitutes 2.5 million tons, and as Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, a community of recyclers is making money and having an impact.
Every day in this junkyard provides an opportunity to make ends meet for 30-year-old Awodu Suleiman. He has been here every day for 6 years, scouring heaps of waste for recyclables. When he's done gathering and sorting plastic or aluminum, Suleiman sells what he has found to recyclers for processing.
This work is money for me, and that is why I'm doing it with passion. From this job, I got married to my wife, and it sustains us. Life has been easy with me.
Local recyclers, including 55-year-old Mahmoud Ahmed, buys plastic and aluminum waste at a low price, then convert it into reusable products, especially pots, local burners, and cookware before they are sold.
I started this work in Lagos before I came to this place. From what I get from the sales of my pots, I'm able to pay school fees for my 7 children.
The venture is nothing more than a means of daily survival for the recyclers, but experts say local recycling has more significance. Nigeria is one of the biggest contributors of solid waste in Africa with an estimated 32 million tons a year. Environmental engineer Marianne Ashenku, the founder of Community Waste and Recycling, says that while small in scale, local recyclers are making an impact exchanging trash for cash.
Almost any country in the world has problems with waste management, so Nigeria is not a particularly peculiar case. So the thing is, the fundamental problem we have is because of the logistics that's in the sector. Waste management is pretty expensive.
In 2009, the government awarded contracts for the procurement and installation of recyclers in 26 Nigerian cities, including the capital. But little of what they recycle is plastic. Solid waste management is the most pressing environmental challenge facing urban and rural areas. Nigeria's population is estimated to double by 2050, and that could mean more solid waste hanging around and more plastic for recycling. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
A report by the UN Refugee Agency finds more than half of the world's refugee children, some 3.7 million, do not go to school and will not gain the skills needed to build a productive future. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report at the UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The statistics on education for refugee children worsen as the children grow older. The report finds 63% of refugee children go to primary school, compared to 91% globally. But that dwindles to only 24% of refugee adolescents getting a secondary education, compared to 84% globally. The UN Refugee Agency says lack of money is keeping refugee children out of school. The head of the Global Communication Service and UNHCR spokeswoman Melissa Fleming calls the failure to invest in refugee education short-sighted. She says this is not only sad, but also foolish.
Not investing in refugees, people who have fled war zones, people who fled countries where the world is interested in a future of peace, is not investing very simply in the future of its people who are interested in reconciliation and not revenge.
The UNHCR is backing a new initiative aimed at kickstarting secondary education for refugees. The initiative will seek to construct and refurbish schools, train teachers, and provide financial support to refugee families to cover the expenses of sending their children to school. Mamadou Diagne Bald is UNHCR Deputy Director of the Department of Resilience and Solutions. He tells VOA some pilot projects on secondary education for refugee adolescents will be conducted before the initiative gets fully underway.
We are going to start in a very resolute manner in a given number of countries in the Eastern Horn of Africa, in Asia, and then move into greater number of countries, also being aware of the scarcity of resources that such an initiative.
The UNHCR says bringing this initiative to fruition will take vast sums of money, but an initial outlay of $250 million will get moving the process of improving refugee enrollment in secondary education. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Stand up!